My name is Selene Kurka, and I cordially welcome you to my podcast, Dein Musikleben. I have studied classical singing and music, and I have been singing for many years, lots of contemporary experimental music, and I do performance. If you would like to know more about me, please look at my website www.irenenekurk.de. And I also welcome you to subscribe to my monthly newsletter. In this podcast, I talk around themes all around contemporary music. I share with you the backgrounds, the insider knowledge, and I really want you to bring the human beings out of this magic new music world closer to you. Thank you for all who are reaching out to me, who are listening to this podcast, and who give me very profound and honest feedback. It touches me a lot. And in those moments where I think, oh my God, this podcast is a lot of work, I'm motivated to keep going. I'm cooperating with the NMZ, the Neue Musikzeitung. It's a great German newspaper about music. And yeah, if you understand German, you should check it out. And yeah, this is now the third interview I'm doing in this collaboration with Rainy Days Luxembourg, Rainy Days Festival at the Philharmonie in Luxembourg. And I'm so excited about this cooperation in many regards. Some of those things you will find out eventually also. But I'm a big fan of Catherine Kons. She is the artistic director of this festival, and I like her spirit. I like how she presents contemporary music, how she curates. And if you would like to know more about her, there is a recent interview about her curating this festival. You will find this on this platform. And I also have been interviewing her, I think, about 2 years ago, where we talk about her as a composer and as a musician. So I'm really excited to support this festival with my podcast. And today I also have a very exciting interview for you with the harpist Rodri Davis. And he will also talk about his program he's presenting at Rainy Days, Extreme Harp. And a funny side note, we will talk about that too. We have been on a CD together since 2009, and it's a recording by the composer Antoine Beuger, a Wandelweiser recording. You will find all about this as well. It's just a very sweet side note. So let's dive into the interview with Rodri Davis. Hello, Rodri Davis. I cordially welcome you today into my podcast, Neue Musik Leben.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here.
And I'm so excited to have you here for many reasons. One is you are performing at Rainy Days Festival Luxembourg this year, 24, with your harp or different harps. We will talk about that. And the other thing which I find very excited, or maybe it's exciting for both of us, we have a common friend and colleague, Antoine Beuger, and I have recorded a CD with Jörg Frey, who is a composer and a clarinet player. The piece is called Two, and I think we just tried to figure out if it was like, I don't know, 2010, 2012 or something. And I think it was earlier.
It could be earlier. I think it was, yes. My memory is terrible these days.
And the thing is, there is this version with Jörg and me where we're just alternating pitches, very long pitches. And then there is a piece that you have done with a shakuhachi, or it was a Japanese instrument, I think, right?
I think it's the shō. Yeah.
And you did also a piece, I think, with Antoine, and then he decided on this CD, there's one CD just with pure version of Jörg's piece, and then there's a version, your piece and our piece laid on each other, like electronically, virtually. And so we have been on a CD for a long time, but we never met before.
And we still haven't met in person.
No, but until... it will change next week.
Yes. Yeah.
Looking forward. I'm really excited. And So I would like to know first, how did you find your way into this new and experimental music field?
Ooh, many strands, I guess. But growing up playing the harp, I wasn't really exposed to very exciting or radical pieces during my youth. And I was always kind of listening to jazz and listening to different musics that seemed far more exciting to me than the harp pieces that I was playing. So when I got older, I was doing my undergraduate in Sheffield University, and I was sort of researching. Well, I came across Michael Nyman's book, Experimental Music, and that opened up a whole, wealth of musical activity that I hadn't heard of before. And I was particularly drawn to the scratch orchestra chapters, and there was a picture of John Tilbury tied up in some rope on the floor. And these and there was some and I'd already experienced some Fluxus artist, and all of a sudden the musical side of Fluxus was discussed there, and it was just so exciting because at the time a lot of this information was really difficult to get hold of. And then, so that was one strand, the sort of experimental music side. But also I was a student and I was living in Sheffield, I walked past a pub and Peter Brotsman was playing, and little did I know what I was letting myself in for, but that blew my mind, that performance. And he was playing with a bass player called Simon Fell. And a year later I sort of met Simon again at a concert and I asked to play with him, and then that sort of propelled me into a world of there was no turning back after that.
So, did I get it right? You kind of started with a classical harp, and then suddenly this world opened up, and you then also had to learn all the techniques or also use the harp differently than you have done before.
Well, around the same time, I was sort of improvising on my own in my bedroom. And I think, I was listening to a lot of radio. So there was sort of a late night radio, contemporary classical radio station. And I would experience, whatever pieces would be around at that time. It's difficult to remember exactly what I was listening to, but there was some, I don't know, some Steve Reich. There was Pat Metheny doing some more experimental stuff on the guitar. I mean, it was the, when was it? Late 80s, 90s, early 90s. So contemporary, the music that was coming filtered through to me, it was more, you had the Kronos Quartet. There was more the, I don't know, certain things got through in the media. A lot of the interesting stuff didn't. So it's just trying to find all this stuff was, and I love archives and I love libraries, so I just threw myself into the university library, which was just such a gift, really. That was one of the best thing about studying, was access to the library. And then I later did a master's in Huddersfield, where I am at the moment, for a concert at the Huddersfield Festival. And just the way, there was even more interesting stuff in the library here in Huddersfield, because of course there's a rich association with the festival, and Richard Steinitz's festival, which he started. So it was, yeah. So I just sort of taught myself in a way, just by burrowing into the library and looking at scores, and yeah.
And then you figured out all the whatever techniques on the harp, or did you, I don't know, go to a harp teacher who already could teach you, or
I
you
was
were just
studying with,
developing it
yeah.
all on your own, or yeah.
Well, a lot of the contemporary harp pieces, even at the time, weren't that. You had Berio Sequenza, you had Busotti Fragmentations, you had a handful, Donatoni, Petrazzi. They were all in the sort of modernist sort of, trajectory. But I think a lot of my techniques I sort of developed on my own, but also working with other improvisers. Because when I moved out to London, then I just threw myself into free improvisation, and you sort of, build up a sort of language through trying to work with a saxophone player or playing the harp with a drum kit. It's you have to sort of find other registers and volume, and working on different sounds to compete sometimes with some of these instruments. So yeah, so I think that's when it really took off.
Yeah, I think you just mentioned two important things that improvisation. I mean, I like improvisation myself a lot, but it also can, I mean, not just that it's fun improvising with people, but I think I often discover things about my voice because suddenly something happens or something weird happens in a whatever rehearsal or performance. I'm like, oh, I didn't know that I could do this, but I like the sound. Let's keep it.
Fantastic.
And I also feel, and maybe it's also, I don't know, our generation or our instruments, because when I also started out singing classical music, and then I got slowly into contemporary music. And at first it was kind of modest contemporary music, and then it got wilder and wilder, wilder. But back then I also didn't know if I even could go to someone. I was just learning it all on my own, doing it by myself, which was not the, it's not a bad thing at all because I really own it. But I also like it that now we have teachers, professors who are very knowledgeable and can maybe give you a fast track for
Yes,
that.
yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, great,
Okay.
great. When you then work with composers, what are the qualities you appreciate most in composers?
Ah, interesting. As a harpist, I really appreciate composers who know how to write for the harp. Because most of my life would be, rewriting scores or, correcting. And they're always the same mistakes because they always write as if it's the piano. So that's the main thing. But seriously, as I wanted to build up a new harp, solo harp repertoire, basically, because I was kind of dissatisfied with what was around. And also I wanted it to be a little outside of what one might call career composers. So I would ask friends, I would ask improvisers, I would ask visual artists, and I kind of started my sort of asking Fluxus artists first and foremost. Some of the scratch orchestra, so the big people that I was really excited by, from Michael Nyman's book, I guess it sort of started there, and then sort of built, like a repertoire of about 50 pieces. I asked Christian Wolff; he wrote me a piece, and he's just written a second piece recently, actually for me. So that's super exciting. And then because I was keen for other harpists. Like-minded harpists or people who are frustrated with what's out there, that they could have access to these pieces, and that was my hope that they would sort of infiltrate the harp repertoire with, exciting pieces.
Yeah, you're doing very important work because I also know that the harp is a very complex instrument, especially with all the paddling and I have a friend who explained it to me. She's a harpist, but she actually does not really want to play lots of contemporary music, which, well, that's her decision. But she also, there's a German episode on Patreon where she kind of explains it, and when she explained it, I'm like, how do you do this? Because she also explained it how not intuitive it is. You would ever pedal, I don't know, a third, but you hear a fourth or something, and I'm like, how do you do this? This is way cool. And I think it's so important that composers know those things, or maybe you can tell us what I don't know, are the most, I don't know, three important things a composer really should consider when writing for harp that you can avoid this, and that also other harpists are motivated to play this great contemporary music.
Yes. I mean, I love it because it's, I mean, there are different kinds of harps, but the harp you would find in an orchestra, the pedal harp, double action pedal harp is called. I just love the system, the pedal system, and it sort of suited my mind really because you can set the pedals and all of a sudden you're in C flat major and all the other instruments in the orchestra going, oh my God, you're playing in C flat major, and it's such a headache. But all we have to do is set the pedals. So in a way, yes, it might be very complicated, but also it's very simple for me. But it can get complicated once you have enharmonics and double notes, and yes, it's fascinating. You have to work out a lot of stuff in advance, I guess. So maybe sight reading chromatic pieces can be quite hard, because you can get into a muddle with the pedals really easily. But yeah, I think it just suited my mind really, that pedal system. And then yeah, I really enjoy playing other harps, all kind of like lever harps, and more recently sort of older medieval harps. And yeah, but I think that the well, just the obvious thing that people do, they think that we play with 10 fingers, but we just play with 8. So you sometimes get chords of 10 notes, which are not possible. And then the right hand is kind of the gap between the notes, because on the piano it would be like the, I'm showing you on you can't really hear this on the podcast, but the harp, the right hand, the gap is between the thumb and the second fingers. Anyway, it's just simple things that can be sorted out really easily. But I think the pedal system is the most complicated for people, and it really helps to be with the best advice is for the composer to meet up with the harpist and have a session with the harp in front of them, because things become very clear once you've got the pedal systems in front of you and the harpist can explain it. But yeah, that's the best advice.
Yeah, I think you've really explained it nicely with the, yeah, also the fingers, how it relates or it is on the harp. And I mean, you also have strings and different colors that at least I think you can recognize really fast the, I think the C and the F key.
Yes.
But on the other hand, it's sometimes and some harpists are more sensitive than others that you have to look through, so you always have this thing with seeing. And some I know some harpers, they bring their own carpet because it totally throws them off there if there's something that they cannot see their strings. And I find this very interesting, but it's also great to hear that you love it so much. And so this seems to be the perfect instrument if you're like, okay, this pedaling system, it's fun.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's fun and it's also a headache. But you don't want
Okay.
it just to be easy.
No. We
Yeah.
don't. Well, not if
Well,
you
I
do
don't. I
contemporary music.
try and make life as hard as possible for myself.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit about the program you do at the Rainy Days Festival. I think there are two big pieces you're doing. Why did you choose them, and what aspects of the harp or facets will we hear in this concert?
Yeah, so
It's
I
called
guess,
Extreme Harp, I think, right?
yeah, so the long answer, I guess, is to talk a little bit about Catherine, because Catherine's amazing, and it ties in a bit with my sort of commissioning new works for the harp. And she was one of the first people I approached to ask to write a piece for me, and she wrote a really amazing piece called Tea Ceremony, which is this massive, massive score. And often when I teach students, or go to harp, harp departments in music colleges, all the students love Catherine's pieces, because they really engage them in a very playful but serious way. And since then, I asked her to write a couple of sort of master harp pieces. So a lot of she's got a sort of history a lot with the harp and with harpists. So I was really pleased that she'd invited me to come. And then this theme, I don't know, some of the things I do on the harp could be considered extreme. I find it quite normal, but yeah. So I guess you could think of, obviously, Phil Niblock, incredible composer who sadly died recently. His work is extreme in the sense that it's extremely loud. It's extremely loud. And he would often have a decibelometer with him, checking that it was, as loud as he wanted. And blimey, sometimes it really shakes your internal organs when playing the piece. Sometimes not. Sometimes you're in, because I've played the piece many times, and sometimes as if I'm in the quietest part of a vortex. It's just incredible. The physical sensation of the sound obviously depends on the space, but so it's extreme in how loud it could
How do
be.
you make a harp loud, or is this with amplifying, or?
Yeah, so I was living in Newcastle at the time, and he came up to Newcastle. He was commissioned by AV Festival, which was an incredible festival up in Newcastle upon Tyne, and it was Rebecca Shatwell organized it, and she was amazing. So she, got Phil up, and we recorded, I think it must be about 50 or 60 long bowed notes, very slightly tuned, slightly differently. And the theme for that festival was As Slow as Possible, and the concert was a tribute to John Cage, who Phil obviously knew, and the piece is called A Cage of Stars, which relates to John Cage, and it was using the notes C, A, G, and E. So I think I can't remember exactly, but I play G and E perhaps. But I was bowing like 60 of them. So he multi-tracked all these. So there's a track of all those electric harp being bowed, and then I'm playing along to it, my own notes as well, and adding to the texture. But it's phenomenal. It's even though it's all bowed harp, it sounds like an organ, a pipe organ in the middle. It sounds like bagpipes in different parts. It's just phenomenal. And we did a concert. He invited him to Swansea a few years ago. My aunt turned up, which I was least expecting. And she loved it. She loved it, and she said, "Oh, I could hear your grandmother playing the organ halfway through." It's just incredible. I think just the harmonics and how it interacts in the room. So many sort of dancing things and interacting with your body being shaken. It's a visceral experience. You know, it's a bodily and sonic, extreme.
That's really cool that you can make a harp sound like an organ, and yeah, it sounds really
Well, yeah, I think
exciting.
that Bill did that. I don't know. I mean, it's not treated or anything. It's just how they interact with all the notes interact with each other. It's just incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is on Friday night, I assume, right?
At
In
9 o'clock,
Luxembourg.
I think I've written in my diary 9 o'clock. So it must either that's a rehearsal, the sound check, or the concert. Yeah, this evening, Friday evening. Yeah.
That's the funny thing with musicians. I don't know if you're one of them. I noticed that it's with my colleagues that I never know the time when my concert starts. And I always look up the website
Yes.
of festival.
That does happen. As long as I'm there for the, sound check, that's the important thing.
I always have been at all my concerts, but when people ask me, what time does your concert start? I
Yeah.
never know. So
Well,
you're the same. What is
yeah.
the other piece you're playing next to Phil Niblock?
And then, yeah, that relates a little bit to I was talking about my fascination with early harps. And a few years ago, well, I've always been really interested by this ancient Welsh harp, which the last one ex that existed or was known to exist was about 200 years ago. So there aren't any physical, examples of the instrument, but it was talked about a lot in ancient Welsh poetry and sort of 16th century poetry. And it was a horsehair harp. So I built a horsehair. I had a horsehair built and designed one myself. And it was a sort of wooden body with a horseskin, horsehair, like the tail as strings and horse bone as pegs. So that was the kind of, and that this was mentioned in the law, the ancient Welsh laws of the 10th century, this harp. So it's probably the harp that was longest in Wales. So I built that harp, and it was fantastic. And then, of course, I've become really excited by, I've always been excited by the Bray harp, which is a harp that has little pegs that touch the strings, and it would be said to bray like a donkey, because it would buzz. So similar sound world to a sitar in a way, but a bit more perhaps percussive. And I never really, as a, as trained as a sort of, classical harpist, I guess, never felt I was allowed to play medieval instruments because I wasn't steeped in the, you know. But then I've reached an age I don't care anymore. So I bought one and I just improvise on one regardless. So I'm during lockdown I got a Bray harp, and it's just incredible. It's like kind of a bit like an upgrade. It's like going from a piano to an organ because there's so many harmonics pinging around. It's just so exciting. It's very rhythmic. And also I was very interested by the oldest body of harp music that exists from Europe is called the Robert ap Hugh manuscript, and this is an incredible collection in a very unique tablature, and it's very hard to be decoded. But in the back of this book, there's a list of, it seems to be like alternative tunings for the strings. So you'd have C D E F G A B C going up as a scale, but then alternative notes. So sometimes they'd be in inverse. So the A would be swapped with the B, and you'd have double F or something. So all these different tuning systems. So I like tuning the Bray harp to these different tunings. So I'll be improvising on the medieval instrument in one of those tunings. And in Welsh, that instrument is called the Telyn Rhachiod, which is the witch's harp. Because these little pegs had bent backs like witches. So and then one of the keys is called the key of the witch. So I kind of imagine possibly this key signature relates to the Bray, to the witch's harp, the Bray harp. So I'll be improvising. I mean, it's a very long explanation there, sorry. And we've jumped back at a lot of information about medieval harps, but so I'm improvising in a sort of contemporary way, but using ancient instrument and tuning.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I always like it when there's this different sound, but I'm also very I like old music a lot too, and I also sing medieval music, so I totally understand. And so with this older harps, then you also have those, I don't know the term, it's not like metal strings, but the other strings, right? Or what
Well,
strings
these
do you
are
use?
gut. They're gut. With the Bray harp is gut, but I think the bass ones, they're kind of wound, and there's one thread, very thin thread of metal that runs through it. Beautiful strings, really beautiful. So there's about, I don't know, six or seven of those in the bass. But it's such a fabulous instrument. It's just about portable, so I'll be coming on the Eurostar and coming by train with it. Because I wouldn't want to fly with it, but
Yeah. Oh, you take those on okay. And
yes,
and for a Phil's piece, you get a harp
I'll be
from
bringing
them.
my little electric harp. So it's the first time I'm carrying two harps. So it's yeah, we'll see if I in that was so that's extreme in itself, bringing two instruments at my age.
Yeah. Do you think that there is prejudice against like contemporary experimental music? And if so, what can we do that things change, or what do you do to help to change this attitude?
Oh, I think a lot of harpists are scared of it because, to be fair, a lot of it can be difficult, and a lot of it needs a lot of work on it, but just like any music, I think. So I think some of it comes from fear and not wanting to, you know, do something they don't understand, perhaps. I think I think the best thing is I tell students is to go over to the composition students and just work with them and have new pieces for harp with the others, you know, people of the same age with the same sort of interest. And that's what, yeah, that's the most obvious thing, because also the composers will love to have the resource of an actual harpist and a harp. And then they, you know, some students will grow to love these new contemporary sounds, because it can be really exciting. It doesn't have to be, you know, difficult and challenging. It can be discussing all kinds of other themes in life through the medium of music and talking about what's going on now, you know. But it's also partly helps if the teacher can help, because also I often get sort of called into harp departments when the harp professor is terrified of contemporary music and doesn't know what to do with it, and their student desperately wants to play contemporary music, so I get shipped in.
It's cool that they do take this effort. I mean, they could say, well, don't play this piece, but they invite you. That's amazing.
Yeah, so that's really good. And I love, because it's also, once you meet a harp student that's desperate to play contemporary music, it's like fantastic, because then I can show them all this wealth of different, you know, music that's available. Yeah.
So do you teach also then?
A little bit. I used to do more up in Newcastle when I lived. So I'd be called into the Durham University and Newcastle and sometimes the Royal Northern. But now it's mainly down in because I'm in Swansea, so Cardiff, the Royal Welsh College of Music Drama. So I'll do contemporary stuff down there with harpists when they need it. Yeah.
That's amazing. So if anyone needs to know anything about harp, they can contact you or send you great pieces or so.
Yeah.
And see what happens.
Definitely.
And I read through all your whatever biography, and I'm amazed by everything you have done. It seems to me like you must have been living, I don't know, four lives already or so. It's so vast and huge in so many different areas and really impressive. How would you define yourself, like your portfolio? What all are you doing? Because you're doing much more than just playing harp.
It's probably just a bit obsessive. I don't know. I just think the instrument was a gift to me, because I think with other instruments, there's a cultural baggage. So there's a history. If you look at the saxophone, there's such a history of incredible, phenomenal musicians. Piano, all these instruments have a massive cultural baggage. And I think with the harp, there was, when I was starting out, there was a blank canvas, apart from the work that Zena Parkins was doing, which was phenomenal and really exciting when I discovered it. Anne LeBaron was another one at the time, and Carol Emanuel, who did this, she played on actually Wadada Leo Smith's, he's here now in this festival, and his piece Spirit Catcher was really exciting at the time because it had three harps. So, you know, it's there were fewer examples, and you know, the coast was clearer to do stuff on the harp, and also I guess I could look at other instruments and see what happened on other instruments and try and apply that to the harp. So I was fortunate to work with John Butcher, amazing saxophonist, and I would try and do those sounds that he was doing on his instrument but on the harp. So I think I was just, and also it's such a fantastic instrument because unlike the grand piano, where you have to reach inside and it's maybe difficult to, you know, get into the instrument, and also concert organizers freak out if you go inside the piano, you know, with the harp, it's just all in front of you. And if you were to prepare the harp, it's a joy because you can access it really easily. You've also got the pedals to do some interesting stuff, whether you can tune the notes, you can do so much with the instrument. It's a gift, really. So I just enjoyed exploring all these different aspects, but on the harp, but also exploring the harp in different contexts, you know, like in all kinds of different situations. Yeah, but maybe in, you know, it does, when it's all written down on paper, it looks a bit extreme.
That's our theme today, extreme.
Yes.
Dave. Festival. It's interesting that everything comes from the harp, but you're doing so much. I mean, you're playing, you're composing, you're doing sound exhibitions with harp and pictures, you're curating. There's so much, and I really advise anyone to look at your website and check you out, and also, well, look at Rainy Days Festival website, or if you want to come to Luxembourg, I think it's really worth it. I think Catherine put together a real great, great program. And I'm glad that I will see a little bit of it. So when I just mentioned what everything you're doing, and you just talked about it. How do you get this done? How do you structure your day? Do you have some kind of time management, or are you a free-floating, I don't know, person? How do you do all of this?
Well, things changed a lot when I had kids. They're 4, 13 and 10 now. But once they came into my life, it was as if my whole life had been thrown up in the air and everything fell on the floor in a complete mess. And I always felt a bit on the back foot then because I couldn't really prepare like I used to. You know, even if it was an improvised concert, I would prepare which instrument to take, what equipment. And then all of a sudden now I'd be turning, you know, traveling abroad, completely exhausted and having forgotten many, many items, important items. So in a way, I was actually really, I had to really improvise for the first time. So, and I was, yeah, funny enough, I was reading some because I've been, you know, Christian Wolff is writing this art piece. I was reading a lot of his interviews. And he, when he had children, he changed how he composed. He would compose in short little bursts. And then these short little bits would form bigger pieces, make the big piece. So I think you have to sort of modify how you work after having kids. I think, you know, if you're, you know, I was caring for them a lot as well. So I think I had to change. I couldn't do everything because in the past, when I lived in London, I would play in orchestras. I would playing and do everything I could just to, you know, survive living in London. But I did make a decision when I was 40 to stop playing in orchestras. And I think after having children, I'd learned to say no to things a bit more and just focus on my own stuff. And I think at one certain time, that's all I could do was just improvise solo, perhaps because I didn't have the headspace to do anything else. So it did, yeah, it did sort of focus what I could do. So, you know, I have limitations and I can't do everything, even though if I'd want to. So, and in a way, it was good to focus more on certain aspects because it's you can't run around doing everything all your life.
Yeah, but I observe it by myself also. I think it's maybe part of whatever aging, because I'm also getting more and more selective every year. What I really want to do, and where I'm like, maybe not, or maybe I have done that, but I don't need to do it again.
Yeah, it's important, but also, I mean, a part of me, if it's unknown to me, I will give it a, you know, my inclination is to give it a go, to try it, to see what, even though possibly it is doomed to failure. So it's difficult to stop that wish to find out what it could possibly be, you know, because often in improvised context, that's always going to be the case if it's new to you, the context. So yeah, so it's hard to battle that instinct.
And who or what has played the greatest role in shaping you, and what inspires you?
Wow, that's an incredible question. I think there's a the community of musicians and friends, and you know, I think it's the community of music that I love in particular, and traveling and meeting other musicians from other countries. And I don't know if that sounds really like a bit hippie, but you know, it really, especially in improvised music, it all feeds into whoever you play with, feeds into your own practice directly. And there's a support network, I suppose. Which encourages you to carry on, I guess. But I mean, obviously, all along the way, there have been people who have been really supportive and helpful, and probably too many to mention. But and often they don't come from places you expect either, I suppose, because like my harp teacher when I was studying, Seanette Williams, she played with the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And she didn't really understand what this free improv stuff was about, but she was really supportive and encouraging. And always encouraged her students to find their own way, I suppose. So even though it wasn't something she was into, she didn't dismiss it, which was, you know, incredible at that early age. It was a gift, really. And then, yeah, so I think, and obviously all these composers have written pieces for me. It's just when you look at some of the names, they're just like Alejandro Dieck, just phenomenal, phenomenal, you know, one of my heroes. And to work so closely with her is just, you know, it's just a great privilege, really.
Mm.
So,
yeah,
I can't give you the long list. We'd be here all night.
And what does it mean for you to be true to yourself or authentic in this music business, and how do you keep true to yourself?
Mm. Yeah, it's difficult on that. I don't know. It's hard, isn't it? You just have to try your best. I don't know. I think I said a bit earlier that, you know, I don't make life necessarily easy. And I was talking to Ok Yung Lee, the cellist. She's here in this festival, and she's done the piece that she's doing in this festival before with the ensemble, but she likes doing site-specific concerts. So she's come here, seen the space, and she's completely rewritten the piece in a matter of days. And that sort of not making life easy for yourself. You know, and some of my, you know, perhaps if you look at it on paper, some of my decisions and choices commercially or financially are ridiculous. But I think it actually, sometimes it's important to, you know, do these things regardless of, you know, whether or not they're financially viable, and you know, in the hope that things will work out in the end. But also I'm quite belligerent as well, so I think, you know, I will stick to doing stuff even though they are, you know, not necessarily very wise. I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah. And what does then success mean for you?
Success is just to be able to carry on doing it, I think. Especially, you know, like I mentioned John Butcher before. He's playing here in the festival. He's 70. And I played in his 70th birthday celebrations, Cafe Otto, recently. And I think he had 3 nights. He was playing every night, saxophones, really intense music. And he did 2 sets each night. And it's just phenomenal. It was just phenomenal. And it's just to be able to, you know, do that and continue doing it is just, you know, remarkable, really. So, yeah, I think that seems to be success, really.
And is there anything that drives you forward, or do you have a vision?
I think I mentioned obsessions. I get obsessed with certain things. So I got obsessed with Fluxus art. I got obsessed with Alejandro Dieck's music. I got obsessed with commissioning new works. I got obsessed with the harp in general, the horsehair harp. And I think, you know, it's lucky. You know, really, it's just like I've got this harp as a constant theme. Otherwise, if you know, I'd be just, it helps make it seem as if it's all coherent. But, you know, I think I just find something that really interests me, and I go into it really deeply. And that just sort of, I think that drive is there, and it's you know, it's still there. And yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, who knows where it'll be, what the next thing will be. But I've a feeling, you know, historically, the horsehair harp was followed by the Bray harp. And in Wales, the triple harp came. It's this incredible harp with 3 rows of strings. And I think I need, and it's considered as the sort of Welsh cultural harp, the triple harp, even though it came to Wales in the sort of Renaissance, came from Italy and possibly Spain, but it was adopted as the national icon harp. So in a way, I think I need to address the triple harp next. And
it sounds like it.
Well, yeah, and the possibilities of tuning because it has probably about 90 strings. So it's got three rows of strings, which you can all tune those differently. It seems to be that's where I need to go next.
Super. Well, it's really great talking to you, and I will see you in a few days. And my last question for you is, which tip would you like to give young artists?
I think the best thing is to go to concerts. And it's intimidating and it's scary if you're going on your own. But once you do it and you start talking to people, you can have access to a whole network of mu musicians because they'll all have been in the same situation. So try and involve yourself with DIY sort of concerts and there'll be a support network there for you, I think. I think that's the best thing. Go to event, as many concerts as you like and work out what music you like. And then talk to the musicians and possibly try and play with them. Because I was very fortunate that musicians did that to me and played with me. And then things can happen as a result, I think. But often if you're just practicing at home and thinking you're not good enough. Sometimes it's just great just to be propelled into a scene and then your music will go wherever it will because of what's happening with the other musicians who are there. So throw yourself in at the deep end.
Yeah, that's a real great advice. And it's also, I think, the magic about music that we often perform with other people. It's not like I don't know, sitting at home and doing a painting on my own or so. This is really great. And yeah, I really enjoy talking to you. And we can hear you Friday night at Rainy Days, Luxembourg. So please check out the website and all the other great concerts. And if you haven't listened to the interview with Kathleen Konz yet, she is the artistic director. You should really do so. And I'm very thankful for this cooperation with Rainy Day, Luxembourg. And thank you so much, Rodri.
Oh, thank you. They're lovely questions. Lovely to chat here. Yeah, thank you very much.
This was the interview from today. I hope that it inspired you. And please send me your emails, send me your feedback, because I love to interact with you. Thank you very much that you tuned in with me today. I really, really hope that you liked it. And please tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. I thank you very much. I wish you all the best. Live your music, live your life, and see you next time. Yours, Irene.